Hello and welcome to a special edition of the America Magazine podcast. And I'm pleased today to be joined by our friend and contributor, John Sweeney. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me.
Now, John is the author of several books, the most recently When St. Francis Saved the Church, published by Ave Maria Press in September. And we're going to talk a bit about that. But first, we want to just get a quick report. You just visited a special exhibit here in New York, and that's why you're here. Tell us about it.
I did. It opens tomorrow at 10 a.m. They told me that I was the first person that they allowed in to have a look. Then, and they said it was because I said I was doing it for America Magazine. And they looked up America Magazine, and they said, the oldest Catholic magazine in the country? And I said, I think so. And they said,
that's
well,
right.
That's the reason why we let you in for the sneak peek. So it might have been that, and it might have been that I told them that I was coming from Michigan to New York, and Tuesday was the only day I had, and so could I please see it. So anyway, yes, I was just at Brooklyn Borough Hall, which is just across the Brooklyn Bridge from Manhattan, and that's where the exhibit opens tomorrow at 10.
So we're talking on December 16th, so it opens December 17th, and how long will it be there?
It will be there till, I think it's January 14th.
So about a month.
Yes, January 14th.
Great. Obviously, you have an interest in Francis, but was there anything new or interesting you learned here?
There's nothing new that I learned, but what is there is amazing. I mean, what is there are 19 books, manuscripts, letters. They're all textual artifacts from the convent library in Assisi, and they never leave there other than coming here. They were at the United Nations on private display a few weeks ago, right around Thanksgiving. Some of your listeners might have read that in the New York Times, but I think it was just on private display. And they go on public display, as we just said, in Brooklyn only. So it's kind of an interesting story as to why they're in Brooklyn.
Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah. So it seems that they're in Brooklyn because there is a restaurateur in Brooklyn named Joe Chirico. He's the owner of Marco Polo Ristorante, and I have no vested interest in this restaurant. I'm just telling you the story that apparently he traveled to Assisi as a tourist. He was born in Italy, so he's an Italian, and he knows his way around. But he was there and went to the convent library where anyone can get permission to go and look at some of these things. And he was so amazed at what was there and so impressed at what was there. By what was there, and he had this idea to bring it to New York. And I think that Joe Chirico also is someone who knows to get his how to get his name mentioned in the media, and he's done some of this sort of thing before to draw attention to his restaurant in Brooklyn. So I think he had this idea of bringing crowds to Brooklyn, and he talked to the folks at Brooklyn Borough Hall, and he has been a friend of Brooklyn Borough presidents in the past. And there was a press conference the other day where he was standing there with Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, as well as one of the Franciscan superiors in Brooklyn, announcing the opening of this exhibit. So it's kind of interesting. He seems to be the inspiration for why it ended up in Brooklyn.
I know you're going to write about this for us, and this is new for you. You just saw it, but is there anything that really jumped out at you?
Yeah, I just saw it an hour and a half ago, and I've been in the car trying to make my way from Brooklyn to Manhattan ever since. And so I just have lots of scribbled notes. But sure, I'll give you some highlights. And so the first three things you see when you walk in are a missal that's open to a painting of the Stigmata, Francis receiving the Stigmata, and it's from about 1312. And the image on the page is damaged, the placard tells you, because of the devotion that led the friars to touch it. And then next to it is this sort of equally splendid breviary from about 1322, and it's open to a page with a small miniature of a anonymous friar in brown robe tied with a cord with the traditional three knots. And then next to that is a gorgeous Bible, which is, and each of these is noted by its sort of artifact manuscript number that it is assigned in the library of the Sacred Convent of Assisi. And this is from the 1340s, and it's again open to a page of a manuscript illumination. And this one was very interesting. It's a Bible, as I said, and it's open to the page where Genesis chapter 1 begins. And in the image, St. Francis with a halo is at the bottom, and immediately above him is an image of Adam, and immediately above Adam is an image of the Godhead, which looks a lot like God the Son in particular, you know, the sort of creator word of God. So it begins with those visual kinds of images, but then it moves through a bunch of other things too. I mean, for instance, at the end of the exhibit, and it's not, it all takes place in one room, so someone can easily see the exhibit in about a half an hour. At the end of the exhibit are a couple of letters, the two letters that Pope Honorius III sent to Francis, the first one from 1220 and the second one from 1222. The first one is the one where he forbids admittance of anyone to the profession of the Franciscan order unless he's at least first undergone 1 year of testing. And then the second letter, and this second letter was 4 years before Francis died, so, you know, very much within the heart of the early Franciscan movement, the second letter was to Francis and the early Franciscans, granting them permission to celebrate the divine offices behind closed doors. So very interesting. These are the original letters. So some pretty remarkable stuff in this room.
Yeah, it's 800 years old. It's really quite amazing when you think about it.
800 years old. And just a little bit of trivia, I suppose, is that the room that you experience all of this in Brooklyn, it's Brooklyn Borough Hall, which is right downtown Brooklyn, right across the Brooklyn Bridge from Manhattan. And you go upstairs, and it's called the courtroom. The room is called the courtroom, and it used to be the Supreme Court Appellate Division's second department. And now it is used mostly for ceremonial functions and occasional legislative hearings. And I am told it has often been used as a set for Law and Order. And it has that look. It's gorgeous.
Maybe we can talk briefly about this news story that was got a lot of attention. It seems like it was slightly mistaken. This is about Pope Francis talking about animals and whether dogs go to heaven. Turns out the New York Times misquoted him. But I think the frenzy that surrounded this story pointed to something that Francis was certainly in touch with, which was like care for creation and the fact that people they want to believe that when it comes that animals are more than just, you know, utilitarian objects, that they are somehow connected to us. So that's something Francis taught us about.
Well, and there's a whole chapter on that aspect of the charism of Francis of Assisi in my new book. Okay. I mean, it is an essential aspect of understanding Francis of Assisi, and I would imagine it plays a large part in the way that Pope Francis also approaches the world, and he has said various things that have made us think about that. But Francis of Assisi certainly was one of those characters in history who we find it hard to believe, but I can imagine exist, that they have, you know, an ability to sort of touch the animal world, not just understand the non-human physical world in ways that most of us don't take the time to imagine it, but to actually touch the animal world in a unique way. So yeah, there's all these beautiful stories of Francis, and that's the reason why we have all those images of Francis with birds on his fingers and things. Some of that becomes sort of saccharine to a point where it feels a little irrelevant, but I think there's also a real basis in reality that he was that kind of a person.
Well, that's a good point. You talk about the sacred image of St. Francis. How do you, you know, in writing about him, how do you try to rescue him from that, to kind of present him anew to today's reader?
Well, I sort of beg the reader to let go of those images that they may have learned in Sunday school, or that they may have learned if they read one of the hagiographies of Francis of Assisi, because it really does get in the way. He was such an unusual person. And you lose the unusual humanness of the person when you stick to the saccharine stories. So, I mean, for instance, the statue figure of Francis with the birds on his fingers, you know, that sits out in the garden. It's a lovely image, but I don't think Francis sat around doing that sort of thing very often at all. But I do think that he deliberately and in many ways remarkably cultivated a care for creatures. And so there are stories of him rescuing birds who were in cages, because then as soon as he purchased them or convinced whoever had them to give them to him, he then set them free. And there are other stories that are a little harder to believe, like when he's out in the boat with the fishermen and the fisherman catches a particularly great fish and hands it to Francis as a gift, because Francis already has this reputation for sanctity. Francis blesses the fish and puts it back in the water to the chagrin of the fishermen. And that part is really easy to understand. But then the story goes on to say that then that fish and all the other fish in the lake came up to the surface of the water and bowed to Francis. So it starts to get a little bit silly. But we have all sorts of stories of Francis taking a very careful approach to things like rocks and every piece of paper that he came across. The latter was because he didn't know, he wasn't very well schooled, he didn't know Latin, for instance, perhaps at all or very well. So if he came across a piece of paper or parchment or something, he had no idea if it might have a holy word on it. And if it might, then he wanted to care for it. So he cultivated this relationship with physical things that was so unusual for a Christian, let alone, may we call him a saint, that it is worth remarking and it is worth remembering and it's almost worth imitating, I think, because that sort of carefulness is something that's missing in most of our lives in the 21st century.
Well, you mentioned Francis as saint. That's another interesting point you make in your book, our notion of sainthood and the fact that it's a kind of later phenomenon and that Francis didn't necessarily conceive of himself in that way, whereas other saints may have been trying to lead a quote-unquote saintly life. What was Francis, was he just totally focused on the gospel and on Christ?
He was, and of course, even when you just said that, as you said it, I thought to myself, I sort of quickly thought to myself, you say that and it just sounds so idealized that it's impossible to just kind of let it go and believe it and think that it's then something that we're going to all emulate ourselves because it seems so impossible. But there's something unusual about Francis's life in that he doesn't seem to have looked at it as, some sort of incredible ideal. Instead, he just sort of step by step in all sorts of little ways. He kept looking back to the Gospels and doing what Jesus told people to do. And there's this sense that I have anyway that, maybe it really could just be that easy. And if we are honest with ourselves, we could just acknowledge that we just decide that there's certain things that we don't do anymore. But Francis really did. So yeah, and he was not the real saint industry hadn't become what it became in the couple of centuries later towards the very end of the Middle Ages. And so you have no scenes at all in the stories of Francis or in the biographies, the early lives of Francis, of him wanting to be a saint or yearning to be a saint, unlike some of the saints that came after him, like Saint Catherine of Siena, for instance, or a couple of others where you actually have these images that remind me almost of how I have a 3.5-year-old at home, and I see my 3.5-year-old wanting to become a princess because she loves all the princess books and the princess movies and things. And she sort of looks in the mirror and she looks at her hair and her dress and she wants to be a princess. And there's a lot of stories that of the late medieval saints of them. And I can imagine them sort of looking in the mirror and modeling the way that their hands look and the way that their face looks and the way that they respond to things to be like a saint. And there's just nothing remotely in the life of Francis of Assisi that would give you that impression.
Now, as I said, we're talking 800 years later. You use the term spiritual genius to describe Francis. Is that why we're still talking about him 800 years later? Or was it the people who wrote about him that have kind of continued that tradition and brought him to our attention?
No, I think it's that spiritual genius he had. And I mean, I break it out into about 6 different things. I mean, I think he had a genius for friendship. I think he had a genius for not regarding anyone as other. I think he had a genius for poverty. And what I mean by that is not just that, hey, he decided to be poor, but he made it something that people were clamoring to join him in. I mean, how weird is that? He had a genius for creating sort of spirituality for ordinary people. There were so many people who were following him in the early days of his movement that he created the Third Order because he basically had to say, you can't all leave behind your parents and leave behind your work and your jobs. But there are ways that you can be spiritual even outside of the four walls of a church, which was a bit of a radical idea. He had this genius for carefulness that I was sort of talking about earlier, not just to humans, but animals and fish and rocks. And And that may seem irrelevant to some people, but I think it is sort of deeply relevant in a way that you can learn to be more careful and cultivate a sort of kindness and a gentleness that carries over into other aspects of life. And then I talk about how he had a genius for embracing death as a natural part of life and as something he wanted to actually experience. And his welcoming of death was sort of without precedent, I think, in Christian teaching, and made him not just a man ahead of his time, but I suggest in my book almost a man ahead of our own time. So he had this genius in these various ways that I try and tease out in some detail. And I think whenever someone encounters the life of Francis of Assisi for the first time, which of course happens every day, they are struck with some of these things in a way that doesn't strike them necessarily as easily in the lives of some other saints. And I think that's why he's the world's most popular saint.
Now, when Jorge Bergoglio chose the name Pope Francis, I know I was surprised because I thought, here's a name that's never been used by a pope. It seems like it takes a lot of guts to use, you know, to use perhaps what might be the saint in the history of the Catholic Church. Why do you think people avoided using the name, and why do you think Francis finally chose it?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, and these are not original ideas with me, but I think the name Francis was so associated with this very radical approach to the gospel, and it was an ideal that feels almost impossible to imitate. So it was not something that was sort of quickly grasped onto by other popes. But another reason, and I mention this a little bit in my book, is that Francis of Assisi was never really the church's favorite son, and I mean in his own lifetime. He was not someone, for instance, contrasting him with his exact commentary, St. Dominic, you know, the founder of the Dominicans. The two orders began at the same time. If you look at the life of St. Dominic, he was often on the road to Rome. He was often meeting with members of the Curia. He was often seeking the Pope's guidance or seeking the guidance of the cardinal protector of his order. You don't see that with Francis really at all. I mean, Francis has some of those relationships, particularly after the first 5 and then 10 years go by in his movement, but he's not anxious to seek their approval. He's one of these figures, not just in the history of church, but in sort of world history, who functions more on feeling that he knows what it is that he's supposed to do, and sometimes you just don't ask, and you just go ahead and do what you think you're supposed to do. I think that Francis was of such unimpeachable character that he got away with this kind of approach, but that's actually one of the reasons why we see a couple of those letters that I referred to from the exhibit that's at Brooklyn Borough Hall, those letters from Pope Honorius III. Those letters came at a point in time in the life of Francis when he had started to sort of lose control of his order after the first 11 years or so of the Franciscan order had gone by, and Francis was starting to become ill. He had come back from meeting with the Sultan. There were those in the order who started to sort of take control from him and develop more relationship with the Pope and the Curia and things like that and seek their approval in a way that Francis didn't used to. Anyway, that was a long answer to your question, which is Francis was always an obedient son of the church, but he was never the one. He wasn't, he wasn't a Gregory. He wasn't a Benedict. His name is not associated with the closest relationship with the Holy See.
Now, we're looking towards 2015, and we're hearing that there perhaps will be an encyclical on the environment. I imagine that's something that Pope Francis will point to St. Francis and some of what he had to say about care for creation.
I would imagine it will be all over the place, yes. I hope so, and it'll be just one more way in which we will keep being reminded of that spiritual genius of Francis of Assisi and the way in which Pope Francis is so connected to him. I mean, that would be one reason why he would choose that as the next encyclical, for instance. But it is such a fresh, important topic, and it's one of those ways in which the saint of 800 years ago feels quite relevant today.
All right. Well, John Sweeney, again, the author of When St. Francis Saved the Church, published by Ave Maria Press. We look forward to your review of this exhibit and hope to see you again soon.
Thanks very much.